Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Michael Wallace, who's the author of the new biography of Billy the Kid called The Endless Ride. And we're going to be speaking to Rick Stevenson, the director of one of my favorite films, Expiration Date. Right now, I'd like to welcome Linda Siegel with our next-to-last legislative update. Is that correct?
Right, Mary Charlotte.
So have they passed any bills besides the first six that have been signed by the governor?
Well, actually, the governor has now signed 27 bills, and there are about 120 bills up there on his desk. And, of course, these last few days, it's just a flurry of really long floor sessions, and hundreds of bills will pass during these last 3 days.
We've had campaign finance reform. What about some of the other controversial bills?
Well, of course, probably everyone knows that the governor did sign yesterday the D. Johnson Clean Indoor Air Act.
No more smoking indoors.
In bars, restaurants, workplaces, it's all over starting June 15th.
Now, I got an email, I think yesterday, saying that there was legislation to put a dam on the Gila River, and I know a lot of people have been trying to prevent that from happening.
Well, actually, it's not quite that explicit. There was over $900,000 placed in House Bill 2 to study water, not to study, to, it's very vague language, but it implies
to do river development, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Gila River water development. And that's not supposed to be a dam, but it certainly sounds like that. And people in the environmental community are very concerned because that is the only free-flowing river left in New Mexico.
Does Governor Richardson have the power to veto or pocket veto that particular provision?
That bill, that line item is in House Bill 2, and he does have the ability to line item veto it. Whether he does it or not, we'll see, because House Bill 2 will actually not get to him till after the 3 day. If you get a bill before the last 3 days of the session, the governor has to veto it or sign it before the end of the session. Otherwise, he's got 20 days after the session ends.
Now, what about, there was so much talk about energy stuff. There was dirty coal, there was clean energy, there was green energy. What's happening?
Well, several of those bills have passed for mandating clean energy. The Red Rock coal bill, the tax relief for the company that wants to build that bill is still tabled, but you never know when those things can pop up right in the wee hours of the night and pass through. But I really think that it probably won't.
That being the coal plant on the Navajo reservation.
Yes.
So energy, education, extending the school day, what else is happening?
Well, the gambling packs, as everyone probably knows, there are 13 tribes in New Mexico that have gaming compacts with the state. Well, there are 10 of them who have signed on to this new gaming compact, which would, over a period of 30 years, this is a gaming compact that lasts until 2037, but it increases the amount of revenue that the state of New Mexico gets from the tribes from like 8% to almost 11% by the end of the period. And these are very controversial because a lot of businesses, non-Indian businesses, say that food and restaurant and other entertainment activities, they have to pay gross receipts tax on, and the tribes don't. And this is the money that the tribes pay in lieu of paying gross receipts tax. But to do something out 30 years is a pretty interesting thing and did generate some controversy.
That's a lot of time indeed. Linda Siegel, anything else before we go?
We'll try to give a better wrap-up on Friday of what may have passed.
We look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks.
Linda Siegel is with us Monday, Wednesday, and Friday during the course of the entire legislative session. We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be talking to Rick Stevenson, film director, in just a few minutes.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the Zia Diner, serving upscale, down-home comfort food in Santa Fe for 20 years. celebrating St. Patrick's Day from March 14th through the 17th, with corned beef and cabbage, Irish lamb stew, Culcannon potatoes, Irish whiskey cake, Guinness chocolate cake, a selection of Irish whiskeys, and, of course, Guinness on draft every day. Open daily from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. at 326 South Guadalupe Street. See ya at the Zia.
The Landmark Dance Theater Company, the Joe Good Performance Group, comes to the Lenzic on Friday, March 16th at 7:30 p.m. Known for its marriage of multimedia and high-velocity movement, the group will present a new work entitled Stay Together, featuring a score by Michael Tilson Thomas, as well as Deeply There, Stories of a Neighborhood, the riveting piece which explores the AIDS crisis. Call 988-1234 for tickets or more information. The Lenzic is a nonprofit organization.
I'd like now to welcome Rick Stevenson. He is writer and director of the film Expiration Date, which screens tonight and next and this coming weekend at the Santa Fe Film Center. It's the winner of many awards for Best Feature, Best Director, Audience Awards at various film festivals. And the film is about Charles Silvercloud III, whose father and grandfather both died on their 25th birthday, each one hit by a runaway milk truck. Charles Silvercloud is 24 and counting down to his birthday. That's the premise of the film. It was one of my favorites back in the December Festival here in Santa Fe. And since we only had just a couple of minutes to talk about it then, we are delighted to have you back now. Welcome, Rick Stevenson.
Hey, thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You have written eloquently about the business of independent filmmaking, pointing out that of the 25,000 films that are made around the world each year, 550 of them get distributed here, and 450 of those are Hollywood movies. And even the 100 lucky independents have little chance of doing well because they don't have publicity budgets. Knowing this, you as an independent filmmaker, how did you go about setting up the business model for Expiration Date?
Well, there's two sides of the model. The first was a production model, and the second was a distribution model. And the production model, I pretty much designed on when I made my very first movie, I was in university over in England, and I had I just got a bunch of friends together. We all got a share of the film and pretty much did it for free. And so I went back to that model because it's the only indie film I've ever worked on that made money.
Right.
And and even though it was Hugh Grant's first film and he was terrific in it, it was probably the worst film I ever made, being my first film. And but for some reason that model made money because it was about keeping the budget low, everybody working for the same purpose, everybody in the same definition of profit, and everybody sort of investing equally in it. And so I went back when we made this movie and rethought how we make movies, because the business is deeply broken on every level right now. And as depressing as that is on one level, it's also encouraging on the other, because it's you know, the Wild West out there. Anything can happen. So the first part of my goal was to redesign how the movie was made, and we did so by kind of following those principles that I like to say I learned in kindergarten, you know, about everybody working together on a similar definition of profit, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we're very successful when it comes to expiration date on making the film that way, and that's why I think it looks, you know, 10 times the budget that it was. But the distribution model was the second half of it, and I feel very encouraged by a lot of things that are happening with the film, but the jury is still out as to whether the new ways that I have approached distribution are going to work or not. And a lot of them have to do with alternative distribution. Let me give you an example. When we released the film in Seattle in the prestigious Egyptian Theater up here, the film was a hit. I mean, it played for four weeks, did very well, and when all the math was done after what we spent and what we took in and the share we took from the Landmark Theater, we lost $6,000.
Wow.
And that was the hit. And so it occurred to me that unless you really have a monster distribution budget, you know, and the average studio one is $37 million to promote a film, that maybe there's a different way to do it. And so the next step was alternative distribution, which basically takes advantage of the fact that for the first time in history, you as an individual or you as a part of an organization, of a soccer team, of a church, of a scout troop, can actually exhibit a film in your living room or in your hall, meeting hall or whatever, in a very competitive and beautiful way due to the new projection systems that are out there that are very affordable to everybody. And that opens up a whole new realm of not only a community experience of being able to recreate what some theaters do, but it also enables you to raise money with it. And so as a part of our website, we offer something called hosting, and so different clubs and organizations can come on and sign up and use our film as a fundraiser.
And what do you get out of that?
50%.
Oh, okay.
So everybody wins. It doesn't cost us much at all other than sending the DVD and putting up the website. And I should just say it's www.expirationdatethemovie.com, and you just go to hosting if you want to take a look at what that looks like.
Now, at the same time, you have said, and we talked about this a little bit when you were here in Santa Fe for the film festival, that piracy is not your great enemy as it is for the studios. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I guess my opinion is the opposite of most people. I think piracy is the enemy of the studios, but I think it's not the enemy of the independents. Anonymity is the enemy of the independents.
Right,
and
right.
That a little well-placed piracy probably would help indie films that would actually otherwise be ignored. And this only works if you've got a good film. If you've got a film that once people find out about it, they tell others about it, and it only works if you still own enough rights to make money off it. But in a way, it's kind of helped with expiration date. Let me give you a perfect example. I got a call from a guy named Hans in Berlin, and this is about 6 months ago. And, of course, the film's never been released outside the United States other than Vancouver, Canada. That's still in the future. And he called up and said, I saw your movie in a theater, and I liked it very much, and it got very good reviews. And I was like, where is this? He said, in Berlin. And I said, well, it's not been released there. He said, well, it was showing in a theater here.
Amazing. So what did you do?
So that would have, rang the bells of Jack Valenti and his predecessors, thinking, oh, my gosh, let's go send the troops in Berlin and find out who's showing our movie illegally. But for me, that was kind of exciting, and suddenly film festivals from Germany were calling and wanting the film, and suddenly we're getting DVD orders from Germany.
Now, when you are in a film festival, do you make money mainly through the DVD? I mean, is that part of the economics there?
Yes. I mean, every once in a while, film festivals will pay you a share of the box office, but that's not very common, and most of them, have their own huge expenses. And so there's kind of an agreement between filmmakers and film festivals that they're going to try to support each other in that way. And I kind of present the film and support the festival, and then they help get the film out there.
We're talking to Rick Stevenson. The film is called Expiration Date. It screens tonight, Wednesday, and through the weekend at the Santa Fe Film Center. Tonight it's at 7:45. Now, given all of this, I mean, you are doing this business. How do you keep the creative flame burning at the same time? I mean, you're wearing a lot of really different hats.
Well, that's a good question, because I've made 11 movies, either as a producer and a director, and directed a lot of television, and I have never stuck with a movie before in that entire history. I make the movie, hand it over to the distributor, and move it on. But, while all of my films have made some money, I've never seen any of it,
mm-hmm.
and my investors seldom see anything of it. And so I thought, there's something wrong going on here, and this time I'm going to stick with it. And so I've kind of been with this film for a year now, and probably will be for another 6 months, just until it's really set up to soar in terms of its many possibilities. And I'm still, the creative juices are just brewing on a different level. That's all. But But right. It certainly is true that as a filmmaker, once you've finished your film, you're only halfway there. And if you're willing to hand it over to somebody, great, but that means you'll lose complete control of it.
Well, I guess we'll have to get an update from you on how this is working, because it's such an interesting way of making a film, and whether it pans out for you, for the actors, for the investors, and so on, I guess still remains to be seen.
That's true, yes. But some very promising things happening with it, and that basically comes as a result of people talking about it and saying, hey, we like this film, and telling others about it, and that traffic being reflected on our website where, you know, we can sell the DVDs. A classic example here, Mary Charlotte, is that through about 35 film festivals, and we probably have another 15 to go or so, we've had, I would say, about 10 distribution offers from various companies. But none of them have made sense financially. They've all offered like a tenth of the production budget up front, and the likelihood being that that's all you would ever see. And so what we've tried to do is pursue a very self-empowered model that is centered in the website and promoted via film festivals and the awards we receive from them, and keeping control of our rights. And that has made a huge difference, because quite frankly, when you sell a DVD for $24.95, and you sell it through Walmart or whatever, and you're lucky to get $2 out of that. If you sell it yourself, you'll probably get $20 out of that.
Right, right.
So, that's the way to sort of make your money back. There's so many middlemen that take it and granted, you'll sell more at Walmart, but you just do the math. I mean, how many more do you have to sell to make up that difference?
Right, right. 10 times as many.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the lead actor, Robert Guthrie. What qualities were you looking for in the actor to play the part of Charles Silvercloud III?
Well, I was looking for somebody that that was such a good actor that they could literally play dead in the beginning.
Right.
That's the challenge of that character, is that he's given up on life. He's going around shopping for caskets and returning his library books. ready to die when he meets a girl that won't let him die in peace. And so that's the sort of setup for the romance of the film. And it's not the easiest character to carry off for an actor, because normally if you're, a lead character in a movie, making decisions and taking action, and that's what makes people love you. I needed somebody that had such subtlety in their humor and dryness and blackness, terms of the humor, and such a stillness that they could draw audiences into themselves, and that they would go with this sort of absurd premise about the about the milk truck.
Right, right.
And Robert walked in the door. I heard him read, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is the guy. And what's interesting about Robert is that in life, he's Johnny Depp.
Right. I heard you say that when you were here. He's got a huge presence, very
yeah.
Charismatic.
Yeah, very charismatic, and women go nuts, and men go nuts. So, he's like a very, very attractive, energetic, intelligent guy. And in this, I just had to shut him down. But the beauty, what you see in the film is you just see that start to open up. And
well, he's practically imploding. I mean, did you have to work hard as a director to pull his energy inward?
Always. I mean, that was my task. But I've got to credit him hugely with pulling that off. For instance, he, as well as the costumers, like if you really look at the costumes in the film, his costumes so reflect who he is, Bessie's costumes reflect. I mean, you'd want to do that in every movie, but this movie has like gotten costume awards because of its subtlety in promoting what's going on with that character. And Robert is the one that created that walk that Charlie does,
mm-hmm.
which is like you're sort of carrying something between your knees.
Right, right.
It's really a wonderful sort of walk of somebody who's just really imploding. And that's a great word. I hadn't heard that used in relation to it before, but it's one of the reasons that, you know, he won Best Actor at the American Indian Film Festival, which is sort of the Indian Oscars.
Now, I've seen the film three times, and it's interesting that it's a black comedy, as you call it. It's sarcastic. You know, this young man thinks he's going to die. He's a little bit of Harold and Maude influence. And yet it's won awards at places like the Spiritual Cinema Festival. Were you surprised that it's been picked up as a spiritual film?
I wouldn't say so much surprised as delighted. I think that the film has, at its heart, kind of my point of view of the world, obviously, because I was, the co-writer of it and the director of it. And my point of view, I believe in a compassionate universe. And so that message is sort of told through a black comedy. And what's wonderful about it is it allows you to pass on that message without any risk of being sentimental, you know, or melodramatic. And I think that's why it sort of works with audiences, because they go in and they're entertained in this sort of Harold and Maude sort of way, and yet there's this sort of, like Harold and Maude, there's sort of this gift you get at the end that's totally unexpected about life and the need to keep dancing. The whole thing about gravity, you know, why does the Earth turn at 1,000 miles an hour? You know, if it didn't, we'd all fall off. You know, that's
right.
The metaphor for life, that you've got to keep dancing, you've got to keep moving.
And so as not to ruin the film for anybody who might not have seen it and who's planning on going this weekend, we will end now. I want to thank you so much, Rick Stevenson, for spending this time with us on the telephone.
My pleasure, and I just want to thank you listeners for supporting the film. It's obviously in being held over. I'm deeply appreciative of the support for it.
And it is being held over because of good audience response last weekend. It's at the Film Center tonight at 7:45, and it's at the Film Center over the weekend, the Film Center, the former Cinema Cafe, and you can go to santafefilmfestival.com to check it out. Is that right? You can Google Santa Fe Film Festival, and you will find the times.
Yeah, and again, I would encourage people also, if they're interested in the film, to go to the website, which is expirationdatethemovie.com, and there's tons of information and special things on there to look at.
expirationdatethemovie.com. Rick Stevenson, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take another break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about Billy the Kid. Stay tuned to KSFR.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Marshall, and on behalf of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, I'd like to invite you to Living Artists of Distinction, Sherry Levine Abstraction, through May 13th. Levine, one of this country's most prominent artists, is noted for pieces that she's been making since the early 1980s that derive from and reinterpret immediately recognizable works of earlier, well-known artists. The sculpture, paintings, and prints in the exhibit explore the issues of abstraction from the art of Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz, for whom abstraction was a central concern. Join us for this exciting exhibit, Living Artists of Distinction, Sherry Levine Abstraction, through May 13th. For more information on the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, please visit our website at o'keeffemuseum.org or call us at 505-946-1000.
Hey.
Sugar.
Take a
walk
on
the
wild
side.
It's entirely different. Now you have two kinds of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Listen to Undercurrents Wednesday nights from 10 to midnight.
Take a walk on the wild side.
It's a world of diversity at KSFR.
I'd like now to welcome, by telephone, historian Michael Wallace. His latest book is Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride, and he will be in Santa Fe on Saturday, not this Saturday, but next Saturday, March 24th, at 5 o'clock at the Cowgirl Hall of Fame restaurant, sponsored by Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome, Michael Wallace.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. Writing a biography of Billy the Kid must have been a very interesting challenge, because so much is already written, and so much of what's written is conjecture, legend, exaggeration. How do you sort it out as a historian more than a century later?
It's indeed a difficult task to separate the wheat from the chaff, and you're absolutely right. My immediate goal was to compose a biography that somehow could delineate what is real and what is not about a young man who I submit has become America's most famous bad man, and in his case, bad boy. But I like that challenge, and through all my writings, and Billy the Kid, the Endless Ride, my 14th book, and most of all my other work, what I attempt to do is set the record straight, not necessarily revise and certainly not rewrite history, but to find the balance, to find the true story, to sort it out, and simply to tell the story as true and clearly as I can.
And where we don't know, make it clear that we don't know.
Absolutely.
What do we know about Billy the Kid's early childhood, and how did he come to New Mexico?
Well, the short answer is we know very little. But what we do know, thanks to some of the better authors, scholars, researchers, historians who came before me, and thanks to a little bit of record keeping and archival material, the best story, the best guess is this, that this young man who we came to know, especially in New Mexico territory in those days at that time, as Billy the Kid, was born Henry McCarty in the Irish slums of New York sometime in 1859, just shortly before the outbreak of the Civil War, born to a famine Irish widow named Catherine McCarty. He had another brother. We're not sure if he was a younger brother or an older brother. He's reported and recorded as both, even in census records. But Josie and Henry were taken by their mother at near the close of the Civil War to Indianapolis, where she took up with a man named William Antrim, and there the journey really begins as they move westward on their own little mini-manifest destiny trip to wild and woolly Wichita. She contracted tuberculosis, the great wanderlust disease, consumption, and they started moving westward for health and for the mining interest that Antrim was involved in, to Denver, then to Santa Fe, where she wed Antrim, Catherine wed Antrim, and we have the first recorded actual document with young Henry's name in it. He witnessed the marriage at the little Presbyterian church not far off the plaza. It's still standing today. And there his real ride begins. And from then on, from Catherine's subsequent death in Silver City from TB, he goes on the scout, on the lam. And this is where most books, most writers, most films pick up on Billy, even a few years later, and focus just on the Lincoln County War and on the last few years of his life.
One of the things I appreciated about the book was that it painted a really vivid picture of the West, and particularly New Mexico, after the Civil War, without which it's difficult to understand Billy the Kid. You write about the legacy of the Civil War in terms of a lot of things, including the proliferation of guns and the culture of violence that came with the war. Tell us more about that.
Well, you know, as God, it's almost become a cliche, but as you know, some cliches are worthy of repeating, and that's how they become cliches, and maybe that's not even a useful label for what I'm about to say, but the truth is history does repeat itself, and we do come full cycle, and there are many lessons to be learned from those times. And that's what I try to do in this book, is use this young man as a vehicle to tell the story of those times. The Civil War had such a catastrophic effect, not only on this nation, but ultimately on New Mexico territory and well beyond, and the ripples of that war felt even to this day, because it was the rise of the gun culture through the Civil War. For the first time, white men could kill each other up close and personal with great abandon. They weren't killing Indians or African slaves or people who they thought were their inferiors, they were killing each other. And up until the time of the Civil War, the most two common methods of committing homicide, of killing someone, was with a club or a knife. They were either beaten to death or stabbed to death. But by 1865, and to this day, the gun took over. And we armed America during the Civil War. The great munitions companies, the gun manufacturers, Colt, Remington, grew fat and happy off that war. And when the war ended, there was no Civil War syndrome. So these young men from both sides were sent home, many of them limbless, many of them with brain damage, suicidal. Suicide rates jumped. There was great insanity. There was no treatment for them at all. There wasn't even a Walter Reed Hospital. But
such
what
as it
they
is.
Did come back with were their guns. And a lot of these men, not all of them, of course, but a lot of them, especially unreconstructed Confederates, made their way into Texas. And from Texas, it was a short jump over to New Mexico territory.
And New Mexico had in 1880, I was astonished to read in your book, a murder rate that was 47 times the national average.
Yeah, we did pretty well with the art of killing with our shootists. There's a friend of mine in Lincoln, New Mexico, one of Billy's, of course, major haunts, put it, what we had back then were a lot of teenage boys drunk with guns. And there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Alcohol was the drug of choice. And there were plenty of guns, and there were plenty of reasons, rather most of them not valid, but conjured up to kill someone.
We're talking to Michael Wallace. The book is called Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. And Michael Wallace is going to be in New Mexico, in Santa Fe, on Saturday, the 24th of March, at 5 o'clock at the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. Billy the Kid, as you said, lost his mother when he was about 14 years old. His stepfather had gone off to try to find his fortune. And Billy the Kid, really very much alone, soon fell into a life of crime, and his first crime was stealing a piece of butter.
Yeah, well, and that one's, I mean, he certainly committed no high crimes, but many, many barely misdemeanors. But, yeah, he stole a tub of butter. He really caught the eye of the local authorities over in Silver City when he took possession of some clothing which he held for a Confederate that were stolen from a Chinese laundry, and that's what caught the attention of the sheriff, who tried to scare him straight and threw him in the local jail, and he was just on the verge, the sheriff, of taking Billy home, because Henry, he was still Henry at that time, Henry Antrim by that time, played with the sheriff's kids, and he was going to take him home. His wife had scolded the sheriff, and she said, bring that boy home. All he needs is some TLC and some good food. But when he got back to the jail, Billy Henry had skedaddled, gone up the chimney and was gone on the scout over to Arizona. And alas, that was one of his many, many poor decisions.
The way you describe him, he's lithe and nimble and slim and quick and able to disappear up chimneys.
Yes, that's how his friends, fortunately, we have a lot of their recollections, many of which can be trusted, and that's how they describe him.
So Lincoln County, where Billy the Kid ended up, and his name, you can talk about how he became Billy the Kid as opposed to Henry Antrim, it seems to have been rough even compared to the rest of the territory of New Mexico. What was it like, and why was it that way?
Lincoln County, back in that day, was considerably larger than it is now. And it was, well, we all know that New Mexico is not filled, thankfully, with people, and there weren't a lot of people throughout this vast county, but many that were there were vying for as always, the valuable resources of this land of Poco Tiempo. They were vying for the land itself, Mother Earth, Tierra Madre. They were vying for the water, and they were certainly vying for the riches, mineral riches, timber, etc. So you had many, many powerful forces politically, commercial interests, large landowners, cattle barons, remittance people who were sent over from England to build their own empires, and all of these forces clashed. So what happened in Lincoln County is you had we found a great big pot of chili that was most spicy, and it was a concoction that often proved lethal.
How did Billy the Kid's life progress after the butter theft, after the clothing theft, and the escape up the chimney? He was living on the lam. He went to Arizona. What did he do there? I mean, he was a kid. He was just a teenager.
Yeah, he was. Kind of what we would call today a street kid. You know, he was on his own at that time, 14, 15 years old. So he learned to live by his wits very quickly. He became very good as a writer and mastered the art of riding his saddle ponies very well. Became a very adequate and quite good sharpshooter and marksman, and put groceries on the table and clothes on his back by either dealing cards, which he became good at back in Silver City, hanging around some of the gambling dens there and watching his stepfather and brother, who were very good at it. And so he dealt monte and keno, but he also turned to theft. He would have been today like a car thief, only then we didn't obviously have cars, so he was stealing horses, and he was stealing tack and saddles, sometimes from soldiers, sometimes from civilians. And so these crimes and misdemeanors kept gathering steam, and ultimately, in Arizona, he drew his first blood and killed a bully Irish blacksmith, Windy Cahill, who liked to rough him up, and Billy killed him in a bar fight. And again, instead of sticking around, he fled. And this time it wasn't holding stolen laundry, it was actually killing someone, because Windy died very painfully the next day. But by that time, the kid was long gone, moving back to New Mexico territory.
As you say, so much of the story is about what happens when you have these young men dislocated, without families, without work, support, without a sense of belonging. It's no wonder that they formed basically what are the equivalent of gangs, or they are gangs.
Yes, they were, and it was such a melting pot. Well, the whole country was, of course. I mean, we were on the last days of the so-called manifest destiny, conquering the land, taking the land, and we're on the brink of this gilded age, in an age of wholesale corruption, and as Woody Guthrie put it so many, many, many years later in his ballad about Pretty Boy Floyd, another outlaw from the Great Depression that I've written about, Woody has a line that fits the times of New Mexico Territory as well. Some men will rob you with a six-gun, and some with a fountain pen. And so we have these classic land grabs preying upon poor Hispanic dirt farmers, efforts to take the great old Spanish land grants, unscrupulous Anglo politicos and business people, working off the Santa Fe Ring up in right on the plaza in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And the tentacles of that ring reached far down into Lincoln County, all over the territory, and really all the way back to the nation's capital.
We're talking to Michael Wallace, The book is called Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. I just have to ask this. It's not a huge part of the book, but because we are here and that's our listeners are in Santa Fe, New Mexico, what was Santa Fe like in Billy the Kid's era before it really became a marketed tourist generation destination a generation later?
Santa Fe was obviously quite different than it is today. The one thing it was then, and it is today, and it always has been, and in fact always will be, and that's what I like to remind my good friends, is Santa Fe will also always be a commercial town. It's a town of commerce. It's a town of barter and trade. From the days of the Native Americans and early Spanish settlers, all the way through the many flags Santa Fe has lived under, in the great days of commerce off the Santa Fe Trail, etc. Today, the bartering, the haggling, the commerce is done in galleries, in tourist places, and the cafes and bars and so forth. The plaza is not nearly as authentic as it was, but it still remains the heart and soul of Santa Fe. But back then, what we now call La Fonda was the Exchange Hotel, and it was a wild and woolly place. There was sometimes gunplay there. The streets were dusty. They were filled with life and commerce and merchants and livestock, and there was just a lot of lusty folks going about the town, you know. So much has transpired on that canvas, on that plaza, which of course many years before the Kid was much larger, stretched all the way up to what we now call the cathedral that Lemmy built. But it was always the heart of the city, even then, in the days of Billy the Kid.
So Billy the Kid lived his teenage years doing things that you can tell us more about, but basically living a pretty rough life, and he died at only 21. How did he meet his end at such a young age?
He met his end largely because he didn't have enough sense to leave New Mexico Territory after his great and famous escape from the Lincoln County Courthouse, which still stands and looks... If Billy were to be set down in the streets of Lincoln, New Mexico today, he would know the town, except the road's paved and it's a little cleaner. But after he escaped, he stayed in New Mexico Territory. When he should have fled southward and made the classic trek into Old Mexico. But mostly because of a young woman who had caught his eye up in Fort Sumner, he stayed around. And that proved his undoing, because eventually Pat Garrett and a couple other bounty men that he recruited from Texas tracked him down. And on the cusp of a Bastille Day in July 14th, 1881, he was killed in Pete Maxwell's bedroom, the old officer's quarters at Fort Sumner, and died on that hard-packed earthen floor. And Henry McCarty, died, but Billy the Kid, of course, did not. He began what I call his endless ride.
Yeah, and you compare him to Elvis and others who've achieved immortality through their legend. And it's interesting because you raise the question toward the end of the book: was he a good guy or a bad guy? Was he an angel or devil? What are the arguments that people make on each side?
Well, it just depends on the era, you know. He wasn't called, you know, he wasn't even called Billy the Kid until well into the last year of his life, which is amazing. That's when the was placed between Billy and Kid. an editor up in Las Vegas, New Mexico, is credited with that. But already he was a legend, and he was part of myth. He had captured the public's imagination, largely the Hispanic population who adored him, and we can talk about that. But soon after his death, Garrett wrote a big book with the help of a ghostwriter about the kid, and filled, as Jarvis Garrett, Pat's son, told me in the 1970s, a book itself that couldn't fully be trusted because there were a lot of half-truths and exaggerations. Garrett didn't want to be remembered for killing some 21-year-old wandering cowhand, so he was built into this bigger-than-life figure. And that, along with all the folklore created by the Hispanic population that adored him and others, and the dime novels and so forth, it all added to fuel to the fire. And at some periods of time, he's treated as the devil incarnate, and at some times he's an avenging angel, when in fact the truth lies, as always, somewhere between. It's not black nor white. There are many, many shades of gray and lots of nuance.
One of the many continuities between that time, over 100 years ago, 125 years ago, and today, is the controversy about bilingual education. I was interested to read toward the beginning of the book. Billy the Kid learned to speak Spanish like a native, and tell us about his relationship with the Spanish-speaking community.
The kid was pure Irish, but he contradicted a lot of the Irish stereotypes. Not all of them. He didn't drink, for example. He never caught the quote-unquote Irish flu. He didn't smoke either. He certainly wasn't a goody-two-shoes, but he embraced the Hispanic culture, and a lot of it came because of his own love from his mother, Catherine, of song and dance, of music. He was very musical. And obviously had some rhythm, but he loved to go to fandangos. He loved to go to dances, and he liked everything from what we know about the Hispanic culture. He liked the cuisine. He liked the color, the flash, the history, the entire culture. He often wore a sombrero. Sometimes he wore beaded moccasins, and he did master very, very quickly, especially in Silver City, the Spanish language. And so he seemed to understand that culture and embrace it to the point. He was not the racist that so many were, especially those who were trying to be, you know, good Americans, with a very, very uppercase A, and treat the Hispanic population, either the Hispanic population that goes back so many generations in New Mexico territory history, or the Mexican people who came up from old Mexico and became what we sometimes call Mexican Americans. He liked them very much, and they liked him, and he became their champion. He became a classic social bandit, much like a Viet Cong or a guerrilla who could live off the land and the goodwill of the villagers and so forth. And someone who represented, was a symbol, fighting back against the establishment, against the fat cats in Santa Fe and the federal government and the establishment.
We've just got a minute or two left, and I wanted to ask you, far more man hours have gone into studying and writing about Billy the Kid, including scholarly conferences, books, websites, dime store novels, than Billy the Kid himself ever lived. What do you think he would have thought of that, of the incredible attention paid to his life?
I can only guess that he would have thought it was a hoot. I'm sure he would be dazzled by it all. After all, he was and always will be 21 years old. He was a kid, and I'm sure he would be greatly surprised by it all. I don't think he necessarily sought the limelight. I think this young man had a fairly healthy ego, but I truly think he'd probably be tickled by it, and I kind of hope so.
Well, Michael Wallace, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, talking about your book, Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride, which was published by Norton. Thanks for spending all this time.
I appreciate it, and I look forward to being with you all in my beloved New Mexico.
We look forward to that, too. And Michael Wallace will be here on Saturday, the 24th of March at 5 o'clock at the Cowgirl Hall of Fame on Guadalupe Street, sponsored by Collected Works Bookstore. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team under the direction of Bill Dupuy. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we will see you tomorrow. Ciao.